Hi, this is John, the creator of Tale of the Manticore. I wanted to add this note to my first episode to thank you for giving my podcast a shot. I'm very aware that there's a sea of options to choose from. I hope that you'll find that your time was well spent. Just before we get on with episode zero, two quick things. One, I wanted to say that at the beginning, even though the audio is not bad at all, just a bit furry here and there, it begins to improve noticeably starting with episode 5, and gets a fine-tuning even after that. 2. Recently, a listener wisely suggested that I clarify my usual disclaimer regarding mature audiences. Where sensitive materials are concerned, which lines do I cross or not cross? Here's what you can expect from Tale of the Manticore. There are frequent and detailed descriptions of violence, accompanied by graphic sound effects. Sexual assault and torture are sometimes referred to, but I do not explore, dwell upon, or describe them in any detail. As for sex and profanity, they of course exist in my fictional world, but I do not have any intention of writing about them in a meaningful way. I hope these details will help you to decide whether or not my podcast is right for you. One more time, because it cannot be overstated, thank you for listening. And now, on with the show. The following podcast is intended for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Tale of the Manticore. Like the creature from which it takes its name, Tale of the Manticore is a mashup. A crossbreeding between two different species of storytelling. Here you will find the unpredictability of old-school paper and dice games with the storycraft of a dark fantasy novel. In Tale of the Manticore, nothing is on rails. The dice determine all. When reading a novel, we wonder how a character will survive a given situation. In Tale of the Manticore, the plot is not predetermined, and there is only if a character will survive. No character is sacred, and no character will be spared. If the dice decide, their fate is at hand. The only guaranteed survivor is the story itself. In this way, Tale of the Manticore is more akin to a game than a story. However, Tale of the Manticore also does not have players. Here, there is only the storyteller and the dice. According to lore, the Tale of a Manticore is barbed with cruel iron spikes. There will be much pain in the days ahead. Once again, welcome to Tale of the Manticore, and thank you very much for giving this podcast a chance. I appreciate your time and will try my best to make every episode exciting and compelling. On this episode, because it is the first, I wanted to begin with a short explanation of how I came to do this, and also spend a few minutes discussing the mechanics and rules of the game elements I'll be using. If you'd like to get right into the story, just skip ahead 5 or 10 minutes until you hear the narration. So, I came to begin this project in a few different ways. I've been consuming podcasts voraciously for a couple of years now. I also love fantasy and dark fantasy novels and RPGs. I'm hoping to recapture the feeling of boundless excitement I had when I was just a kid, reading through the original D&D rulebooks, enthralled by the art of Errol Otis and Jeff D. In the spirit of trying to bring these feelings back to life, I will mostly be applying old school rules to the creation of Tale of the Manticore. I spent the last couple of years searching for the perfect podcast for me. I found some good ones, but the vast majority of D&D-related podcasts I found to be, well, something just different from the game that I loved. There are a lot of comedy live play podcasts, but only a few where I found the story immersive, where I could really suspend my disbelief. I started thinking about making my own, but it never really solidified into a plan. I was still hoping to find one someone else had made. One day I was watching the news and I saw a clip of an interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda. He was being asked for his advice for young composers, and he said something that stayed with me. To paraphrase, he told the interviewer that young composers should make the thing that did not yet exist, but that they wished did. I thought about that a lot, I really did, and I decided to take his advice. I wasn't exactly sure what I would make, but I knew what I wouldn't, and that was a start. In Tale of the Manticore, you'll find no gnome samurais named Big Daddy, no half-orc paladins with an intelligence of 3 named Inevitably Grog. There will be no dwarves named Inevitably Grog. There will be no one named Grog. If those are things you love, good news, there are plenty of hilarious podcasts out there just for you. So in Tale of the Manticore, there will also be none of the elements of new school gaming that I feel do great damage to the suspension of disbelief. There will be no Dragonborn, no Tieflings, no Kung Fu, no Bards as a class. Another thing there will not be is the sound of me eating and drinking into the microphone. For many people this is not a problem, but for a few of us, myself included, it really is. Here's what you will find. Fairly short episodes. A strong effort to maintain suspension of disbelief and create an immersive experience. An effort to capture the purity of the old school RPG and an absolutely slavish devotion to the dictates of the dice. As the storyteller, I plan to be along for the ride, and I will not know what will happen in the story in advance of it happening. So, let's waste no more time and jump in. We begin this one time with some mechanics, because our story has no characters and we need a few. I'll make 5 characters, one of each major class. The rules for character generation will be as follows. For each stat, roll 3 dice. Any score of 5 or lower is rerolled. If the prime requisite for a character is under 13, reroll that too. Everything else stays exactly as the dice show. Ready? Here we go. Let's roll up the first 5 characters for Tale of the Manticore. For each character, we'll be rolling 7 attributes. The usual strength, intelligence, wisdom, dexterity, constitution, and charisma. I'm also adding one more attribute, luck, in case I ever need it. Are you ready? Here we go, our first character. Here's the roll, strength. A 10. Intelligence. 9. Wisdom. Another 9. Dexterity. 4. Ooh, that's a reroll. Rerolling. 9. That's better. Constitution. 13. That will give this character a +1 bonus to hit points. Charisma. 11. Luck. 14. Well, looking at these stats, it's nothing exceptional, but with a good constitution and a decent strength, I think this will make a good dwarf character. Here's our next one. Strength. 8. 8 will give this character a -1 penalty to hit and damage rolls. Intelligence. 17. Finally, a good roll. That will give this character a bonus to languages. Wisdom. An 8. Dexterity. A 9. Constitution. 13. Charisma. 7. Another penalty for this character, this time 4 reaction rolls. Luck. 10. This character is clearly our magic user. With an intelligence of 17 and a strength of 8, there's no other good choices. The low charisma might make for some interesting role-playing later. Let's roll up our third character. Strength. 12. Intelligence. 11. Wisdom. 14. There's a bonus there for some saving throws. Dexterity. 13. Another bonus, this one to armor class. Constitution. 14. Yet another bonus, this time to hit points. Charisma. An 8. That's a -1 penalty for reaction rolls. Luck. 14. This character is extremely well-rounded and above average in almost every way, with the exception of charisma. Because of the high constitution and wisdom, I think this would make a good cleric. Our fourth character, strength. 13. This character will have plus 1 on to hit and damage rolls. Intelligence. 9. Wisdom. 11. Dexterity. Another 11. Constitution. 12. Charisma. 13. There's a plus 1 on reaction rolls for that. Luck. 14. This character has good strength and good constitution. It's a no-brainer that this character will be our fighter. Our final character. Here are the rolls. Strength. 5. That's a reroll. Rerolling. 11. That's better. Intelligence. 9. Wisdom. 10. Dexterity. 14. This character will have an AC bonus. Constitution. 9. Charisma. 15. This character will have a bonus here as well. Luck. 15. This last character has really good stats. Almost everything is above average. With stats like these, this character would make a good rogue or thief. And that completes our character generation. Now, one house rule that I'll adopt in character creation is that all characters will begin each level with their maximum possible hit points. That's about the only benefit my characters are going to get. On the other hand, these characters will begin life with certain disadvantages. They'll have no equipment, no weapons, no armor, and they'll begin life already feeling the effects of hunger and thirst. Here's a quick recap of the characters I've created for the beginning of our story. The first is Soli, a male dwarf. He has 9 hit points. His stats are mostly average, but he does have a bonus to his hit points due to his high constitution. Next is Umura, a human female magic user. She has a very high intelligence, getting a bonus to languages. She gets a bonus to her constitution as well, so her starting hit points will be 5. This character also has penalties in strength, wisdom, and in charisma, with a minus 1 to each. Next up is Girios, a human male cleric. He also has a hit point bonus and begins life with 7 hit points. In addition, he has a dexterity bonus to his armor class of plus 1. He also gets a wisdom bonus, which will give him a benefit on some saving throws. Finally, he has a penalty to his reaction checks due to his slightly low charisma. Our fourth character is Kagan. He's a human fighter, male, with 8 hit points. He has a strength and a charisma of 13. Our final and fifth character is Aridine, a human female rogue. She has 4 hit points. And due to her high stats, she gets a bonus of plus 1 to her AC and a bonus of plus 1 to reaction rolls for her high charisma. Well, let's throw these characters in and see how they do. Prologue. The prisoners' forced march only stopped during the daytime when the goblins, 4 of them, took turns at sentry or rest, or amused themselves by beating the men and abusing the women. At these times, from sunrise to sunset, the prisoners were hooded. These hoods were only removed at night, so the prisoners lived in perpetual darkness and isolation. At night, they watched the stars twinkling above as they stumbled through mile after mile of hilly woods towards some unknown destination. At sunset, the hoods were removed, but still the prisoners could not communicate with each other. Early attempts to do so had resulted in swift and harsh beatings from a lead goblin who carried a thick wooden club and used it at the slightest provocation. At all times, their wrists were attached to a stout pole that connected all seven of them, one in front of the other. Kagan had been a prisoner for 3 days. His party had been attacked and overcome by a horde of goblins on the road to Burke. Most of them had been killed on the spot. Others had been dragged off into the woods for gods know what purpose, but he was corralled with four others to form a chain gang. They were taken to a series of dark caves where they were beaten mercilessly and left bound and helpless for many hours before a small detail of new goblins arrived. Light arguments in the guttural tongue and then coins were exchanged. Soon after, he found himself separated from this group and joined to his present one. Of the dwarf, the two other men, the two women, or the young girl tethered to his pole, he knew almost nothing. All seven were filthy and starving. They'd been stripped to their ragged undergarments, and they showed the physical signs of the goblins' maltreatment. They were barefoot, weak, and starving. For days, they'd been fed nothing and given a few mere sips of water. The pole they were forced to carry was a heavy burden. Heavier still was the sure knowledge that whatever fate awaited them, things would almost certainly get worse. A suggestion of dawn was coloring the night sky at the horizon when the lead goblin, the one who bore the cruel club, spoke some words and signaled a halt. As one, the goblins drew their weapons and fanned apart, hissing commands at each other and looking wild-eyed into the dense forest ahead. Presently, there was a whoosh and a rock the size of a child's head rocketed through their midst, striking the trunk of a thick oak behind them. The prisoners, alarmed, tried to scramble in different directions, but the pole to which they were tethered prevented any such movement and instead bore them all to the ground as they lost their footing. Kagan found himself kneeling, struggling to his feet when the treetops shook and a huge figure came into view. The thing that stood before them, ignoring the prisoners and intent on the goblins, was very large. It was shaped as a man, but taller and unnaturally thick with muscle. It might have weighed as much as a bear and looked as strong. Its eyes, black under a heavy brow, looked dull and stupid. The mouth gaped open. Two short tusks protruded from a lower lip that dripped saliva. In its right hand, the ogre held a stout, gnarled tree trunk, stripped of its branches to form a crude club. The roots at the end splayed out to form a wicked spiked end. In its left hand, it held another large rock. Without breaking eye contact with the goblins, the ogre pointed at Kagan's party with its club and pounded its broad chest with the hand carrying the rock. The goblins understood quickly, but they were not keen to surrender their slaves. They looked to each other, worry and hate etched in their deformed features, and then raised their various weapons. Other than the club wielder, the goblins carried a dagger, a bow, and a short sword among them. Dramatis Personae. Kagan. Kagan is a level 1 human male fighter. He is 20 years old. He has brown eyes and wavy brown hair that he wears somewhat short. He usually has a full beard. At 6'1" tall and 190 pounds, he's a big man and can come across as intimidating to those that do not know him well. Adding to this is the fact that Kagan doesn't smile or laugh easily. In truth, he is more stoic than he is foul-tempered, though he is prone to depression at times, as he grieves the passing of his father just 6 months ago. Kagan is a natural leader, though he does not fully realize this yet. People tend to trust him and to listen to him. He has a sincere quality, and in truth, he is sincere. There is nothing of guile in Kagan. He is a simple woodsman, nothing more or less. He is skilled at forestry and setting traps. He can hunt, though he is not a great shot with a bow. His preferred weapon is the axe, a tool that feels comfortable in his hand. He has no real experience with combat, but he will soon discover that he is both brave and fierce in a fight. Kagan was born and raised in Briar Hill. His mother passed when he was a child, and he has no memory of her. Having no siblings, his father was his whole family, and so when he passed, taken by disease, Kagan lost everything. He soon left Briar Hill in an effort to escape the constant reminders of his loss, and found woodcutting work in the nearby town of Sparrow Lake. There he stayed for 6 months before growing restless and moving on to a good job site rumored to be found in Burke. But he never made it there. Traveling with just a large family of nine, including children, for companions, he was an easy target for the slaver goblin horde. Part 2, Prologue. Day 1, Dawn. Kagan watched, a helpless observer, as the bow-wielding goblin, arrow already knocked, suddenly jabbered a curse, pulled back, and let fly. The arrow sailed wide, slipping into the woods with a hiss. The attack enraged the young ogre, who raised his makeshift club and brought it down atop the archer. With an audible cracking of bone, the goblin collapsed under the blow as if made of straw. The other goblins lunged at the huge creature, and though they hit and cut him, they were no match for his power. The young ogre stomped about, almost like an infant throwing a tantrum and bellowing in frustration. One foot landed atop the archer's corpse, and a sharp twang sounded as the goblin's bow snapped in half. The hand holding the large rock found a target, shattering the dagger wielder's jaw. That goblin was dead before he hit the ground. Now only two goblins remained. They looked at each other in panic and then back at the young ogre. The swordsman dropped his weapon to the ground and took flight. Seeing this, the lead goblin followed. The ogre took some moments to calm down. The heaving of its huge chest slowed. It grunted several times and scratched at its minor wounds before turning its attention to the bound slaves. It snorted once like a horse and then raised its weapon arm. Before anyone had a chance to even think, the club, covered in goblin gore, came down on the skull of the young girl and crushed it with a sickening crunch. One of the prisoners, a large blonde man, was the first to react. He surged uselessly against his bonds and swore,
"You bastard! You demon! Cut these bonds and—"
He never finished his sentence, for the ogre, with a blank look of not understanding or caring what the man said, had thrust the tip of his club into the man's chest and crushed his ribcage. Now there were only five prisoners remaining, two men, two women, and the dwarf. The ogre presently dropped his rock and club and approached their line. With dark, rough hands, he reached in amid their cries and broke the restraining pole in two. He then snapped the binding rope as though it were a piece of thread and dragged the attached corpses of the blonde man and the child away from the group. He pointed at the survivors and then at the ground.
"You stay."
With that, he picked up his club with his right hand. His left pulled the rope with his catch over his shoulder as though it were a line of fish. The ogre trudged off in the direction it had come without looking back. The prisoners said nothing for a long time. Finally, one of the women broke the silence.
"Time to go."
To the amazement of the other prisoners, she slid free of her bonds.
"Thank Mazagar," said the other man. "Now free us. Do it quickly before that thing comes back."
"How did you escape?" asked the other woman. She was visibly older than the first, and Kagan noticed, not for the first time, that her skin was adorned with mystic tattoos.
"Been starving for days now,"
came the reply.
"Actually, I could have slipped my bonds yesterday, but those damn goblins never let us alone for a moment."
A look of disgust crossed her face. Then she shook her head as if to clear her thoughts, and she wandered a short distance away and rifled through the fallen goblins' corpses. She took several items, including the abandoned sword, dagger, a water skin, and a belt pouch before giving the nearest corpse a hard kick.
"Rotten hell."
At this point, the prologue narration is over and uncoupled from my decisions as a writer. From now on, we'll let the dice decide what happens. One of the still-bound prisoners will appeal to Aridine, who has freed herself, for help. But Aridine does not know these people, nor does her personality dictate a necessarily altruistic behavior. There are four characters still bound: Soli the dwarf, Umura the magic user, Girios the cleric, and Kagan the fighter. I'm going to roll a die 8. On a 1 or a 2, Soli will ask Aridine for help. On a 3 or 4, Umura will. On a 5 or 6, Girios. On a 7 or 8, Kagan will ask. Here's the roll. It's a 3. Umura will ask first.
This is bad luck because she has the lowest charisma of the group. I will rule that Umura needs a 7 or higher on a 2d6 in order to persuade her to cut them free. And the roll. A 6. Even without her -1 penalty, she has failed. Still, this is not a critical failure. Let's see how this will play out in roleplay. You must free us, said Umura, perhaps a little too imperiously. She quickly perceived her mistake and tried again. I mean, please, please help us. That thing will return. You know that. Eridine nodded and began to move toward them, but stopped short. She had noticed the magic user's tattoos, mystic signs inked onto various parts of her body. Eridine had never seen anything like that before, and she instinctively mistrusted anything she did not understand. She frowned to herself and then spoke.
Forgive me. You would only slow me down, but perhaps you may yet save yourselves.
She tossed the goblin's dagger into the brush near the others as they stared at her, horror-stricken. Eridine repeated,
Forgive me.
Before dashing into the woods and quickly disappearing among the trees. The prisoners were again suspended in stunned silence for moments before Girio said, That knife, we need to find it right away. Mazagar knows that thing will come back as soon as it gets hungry. Everyone quickly agreed, and the group maneuvered themselves toward the place where the woman had thrown the dagger. It took several minutes of searching before Soli found it and began sawing at his bonds. Once he was free, he did not hesitate to release the others. Bless you, Master Dwarf, said Girios. We should take what we can and leave this place immediately before. Agreed, said Kagan. He was rubbing his wrists and moving toward the goblin corpses. Is anything left here? Let's see. 2 water skins, a broken short bow, and a pair of belts with pouches attached. These pouches seem to contain something. Coins. The change from our purchase, perhaps, ventured Umura, stepping over to collect some of the items. Fellows, I suggest we go back the way we came. Eventually, perhaps, we can find a road or a river. If we're lucky, a town, some help.
Aye,
said the dwarf.
Ahead can be only enemies, and in that direction,
he said, pointing off to where the ogre had gone.
With the beast.
The party agreed, and gathering up what they could, ventured back in the direction from which they had come.
Thank you for listening to Tale of the Manticore. If you enjoy what you've heard, please consider leaving a 5-star review for the show on iTunes. It helps a great deal. For show notes, more behind-the-scenes info, rants, and random thoughts, please visit taleofthemanticore.blogspot.com. Our story continues in the next chapter of Tale of the Manticore, the story where chaos rolls.